Hello and welcome to another bonus episode of the Supermassive podcast from the Royal Astronomical Society with me, science journalist Izzy Clark, and astrophysicist Dr. Becky Smethurst.
We are exhausted from answering all of your excellent questions that you sent in for our last episode 2 weeks ago. So honestly, if you haven't listened to that yet, they were excellent questions. You should go listen to that. But we wanted to take a moment now to have a look at some recent space news because a lot has been going on.
It's like all of the space agencies knew that we were doing this because there's been so many space news stories recently. So NASA, for example, they've recently shared the first results taken from a 4.6 billion year old asteroid called Bennu. And with us, as usual, is the Deputy Director of the Royal Astronomical Society, Dr. Robert Massey. So Robert, can you tell us more about this story? How far out is this asteroid?
Well, at this moment, Bennu is 110 million kilometres away from the Earth. But the point is that in September each year, it can get rather closer than that. So it's what's described as a potentially hazardous asteroid, which means there's a theoretical risk that it might hit the Earth someday. And the cumulative risk assessed for this is about 1 in 1,750. And by the way, that's in the 22nd, 23rd centuries, so no need to panic. It's probably, chances are it'll go down even lower than that. Usually it does that way when people sit there and analyse the orbits more and then work out exactly where it is. But the point is that there's been a mission there to go out and have a look at it. And it takes about a year and a bit to go around the sun. It orbits between just inside the orbit of Earth and out towards Mars. So it goes around in more of an elliptical orbit than the Earth does. But it might actually even be thrown out the solar system altogether or even crash into Venus or the sun instead of the Earth, which would be obviously better from our perspective.
Not so good if you're a Venusian.
Not from the Venusian perspective, no, exactly.
So how were these samples collected and brought back to Earth?
Yeah, so NASA had the OSIRIS-REx spacecraft. Now, it's not the first time that samples have been collected from an asteroid. There's two Japanese missions that have done that as well, the Hayabusa 1 and 2. They collected smaller amounts, but this one collected a lot more. And it was launched in 2016. It arrived at Bennu in 2018. It spent nearly 2 years going around studying it. And then towards the end of that time, in late 2020, it made a close approach very slowly, which is what you have to do, obviously. And it used a jet of nitrogen to blow material off the surface. And because it's such a low gravity environment, and there's obviously no atmosphere, you can do that, blew material into the collection vessel. And the scientists were really pleased because I think it was about 150 grams they collected, which was a lot more than they needed. And then it came back to Earth and it dropped the capsule with the materials into the atmosphere, and a parachute deployed, and it had a nice soft landing in Utah. And you know, might have seen all that wonderful footage of it landing conveniently near a road. And now it's off to another potentially hazardous asteroid called Apophis.
I mean, it's amazing. I mean, imagine if you were just on that road. You just see this little thing like drop down, like, what is going on? Hang on.
And there's all these like scientists chasing. Like,
it's so there, exciting. It's
there. Sort of like catch the pigeon and someone running around with a net. So what did they actually find? Do we know yet?
Well, the samples, they've had their preliminary analysis, and that's what people are really excited about, because the sample has lots of carbon and water in it. Now, those are obviously rather important ingredients for life. So one of the thoughts about the way that water arrived on Earth is whether it was brought by asteroids and comets. And this is sort of saying, well, yes, you know, there is that possibility, because in the early solar system, if you had a lot more material going around, a lot more of it was hitting the Earth, and some of it was asteroids containing water. That is one way of delivering water that created our oceans and rivers and made the Earth habitable. So we look at asteroids and comets and so on, we think, you know, potentially bad news. And of course, that's true in the long run. But at the same time, they might have been really helpful in getting life started as well.
Bad in the short run, really, probably would have been the, because in the long run, it's great. You know, billions of years later, we're like, woo, water. But in the short term, not so good for us.
Not if you were a very simple single-celled organism on the early Earth. No, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, just how important, and Becky, feel free to jump in on this. Like, how important is a mission of this style?
Look, firstly, it's a brilliant technology mission. The idea that we can go off to a body like this, you know, do these wonderful, slow, close approaches, fire a jet of gas at it, grab a sample, return it to the Earth. All of those things, you know, really wildly inconceivable, say, decades ago, before the space age. The fact that I find it really impressive that we can bring these things down through the atmosphere so delicately as well. But it's a really good way of getting that in situ sample. So telescopes, space probes, really, really good at studying the light of objects, the spectra, analyzing what things are made of. But there isn't really a substitute for actually, if not being there, then having a bit of it in a lab and looking at it. And that's what this is about. And some of the samples, for example, they be doing what they did with the Apollo missions, where they'll take a bit of it and store it, because the assumption will be that, say, in 50, 60 years' time, the technology for analysis will be that much better. There's also a bit of it in the UK as well. I can't remember, some tiny fraction, possibly even as little as a gram, that's gone to the UK, but there are places like the Natural History Museum and so on are looking at it.
Yeah, I think when you say how important is it is, like, I always think the biggest question that anybody has ever asked is, where did we all come from? And the thing is, we all know that we're only here because of water. And I think people don't realise necessarily how water deficient the inner solar system is compared to the outer solar system. Like, where Earth formed, we should not have had water.
Yeah.
So there has to be some process that brings it in. And so you could argue, okay, well, maybe you had lots of pebbles drifting in over billions of years, and maybe they could have, you know, formed Earth or whatever. But the main hypothesis is these asteroid collisions. And it's something people have tried to study for years with meteorites that, you know, have actually crash landed on Earth, and they've come to us, and that's very handy. But there's been this question of, are they not just contaminated by having crash landed on Earth? So to actually go get this pristine sample that Robert was explaining, like, it's just, I don't think you can you can sort of quantify how important it is, because it's always just going to come back to, where do we all come from?
Yeah, that big question that always episode comes up about every other episode. Yeah.
I wish I could put that on my, like, funding reasons. This is why you should give me telescope time, because I don't really argue that one for black holes, though.
yeah, exactly. So moving on, I think something must be wrong, because we have probably gone a few months without talking about Webb in, like, loads of detail. But Webb has found some Jupiter-sized planets that are free-floating in space, and they are unconnected to any star. So Becky, what did you think when you first saw this story?
I mean, when I first saw it, I was like, wow, JWST is powerful. The Jupiter Space Telescope, I was like, wow, they can find these things. Absolutely incredible. So, I mean, to put this into context, what they've done is they use JWST to look at the Orion Nebula. Now, the Orion Nebula is huge. It's way, 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 way bigger than the tiny field of view that JWST has, because it was designed to see things very far away, so it looks like right down into the details. So first of all, they had to do this massive mosaic of the Orion Nebula to cover it all. And then what they spotted was 540 planetary mass, so smaller than a star that's doing nuclear fusion, you know, but bigger than, say, about half the mass of Jupiter, right?
Okay.
In the Orion Nebula. And as you said, they're not orbiting any star, they're rogue planets, which is in itself very exciting.
I love that name.
Right?
I'm a rogue planet.
And, like, we've known for a while that they do exist, but finding 540 of them is, like, absolute like, jackpot. Yeah. Because they're so, so small, right? They don't reflect a lot of light. They're not burnt. They're not doing nuclear fusion, so they're not giving off their own light.
Yeah.
So they're very difficult to spot, but when they are newly formed, they're still very hot because of all the pressure, you know, with the gas contracting and that heats up. And so they do glow in the infrared, which is what JWST can detect. So that it makes it easier to spot them with JWST, but obviously still it's not still not overly easy. And it's incredible when you look at this image, just how you can just pick them out. It's kind of mind-blowing that it's powerful enough to do that.
So have we seen anything like this before? Did we know that they were as prolific as it seems that they have been?
Well, I guess it's worth saying that the Orion Nebula is, like, a very dense region of star formation. There's lots of stars forming, which means there's probably lots of planets forming as well. So fair enough. And if there's some interactions in, like, where the planets are forming around the stars, you can get them thrown out. So if you were going to look anywhere, then you'd expect to find them here. But I don't think we'd think they were that prolific necessarily. I mean, we've known, like I said, about rogue planets for a while. We even had one visit our own solar system. Do you remember Oumuamua when it, like, flew through the weird big cigar-shaped asteroid that we figured out was actually not in orbit around the sun? It just happened to have flown by, which was incredible. So we do know about them, but what's really, really, really weird is that, yeah, they found 540 of them, but about 50 of them were in pairs. So, like, a binary planet thing. Which
is just so strange. Like, yeah. Say what it is, it's weird.
Yeah, it's weird. And so, I mean, they were spotted because, like, you see two dots next to each other, right? So there was a chance that, okay, maybe it was just a chance alignment. One was in the foreground, one was in the background. But, like, the authors of the study, they actually estimated, given, like, the density of objects in the field, maybe you'll get 3 chance alignments, but not 50. So there's, like, definite pairs of planet mass objects. So somewhere from around about half the mass of Jupiter up to, let's say, 10% of the mass of the Sun, the sort of lower edge of, like, stars, nuclear fusion, the things we call, like, brown dwarfs, like, a lot heavier than Jupiter, but they're not stars either.
Okay.
And so they dubbed these jumbos, which I quite enjoyed. Jupiter,
big fan of that.
Yeah, Jupiter mass binary objects, jumbos. And the thing is, they break all our models. Like,
oh, good.
Yeah. So we've looked before at, like, okay, how likely is it that you get two stars orbiting each other, right? Because stars form out of a big cloud of gas. So sometimes you get two forming and they end up in orbit around each other. And it's much more common for higher mass stars to get two higher mass stars orbiting each other than it is for lower mass stars. So if you can imagine the graph, it's just like mass on the x-axis, and then you've got, like, fraction of binaries on the y, and it just drops off as you get to lower and lower masses.
Right.
And then they looked at it and been like, well, let's extend it beyond, like, the lower end of stars' masses into planet mass, and it goes back up again.
Oh, good. And that's a nice little head scratcher for everyone to get involved in. Yep.
And so our models of how stars form are all based on the fraction dropping off with mass. So they can't explain how they formed.
Right.
And then all our models of planets forming, which take into account that planets can be flung out of orbiting around their star, you know, because of all the crazy interactions that go on. They also can't explain it because, like, were they ejected as a pair? Were they a pair, like, in the disk around the star and then ejected? Or were they, like, ejected separately and then somehow ended up in orbit around each other?
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
So it could be a combo of both. Like, there could be some heavier ones that formed, like, stars out of just, like, gas collapsing. Or there could be some that formed, like, planets out of, like, you know, the gas that's left over around a star that's formed. We call these, like, protoplanetary disks. Mm. So, you know, there's going to be some more JWST observations to try and figure this out.
You don't say.
They're going to take instead of images, they're going to take a spectra, you know, where they split the light and they get, like, a trace of how much light at each wavelength, and that has a lot of, like, information encoded in it. That should be able to tell us if they formed like stars or formed like planets.
Okay.
But either answer we're going to get, it's going to be like, okay, models.
This is still new information. So.
Yeah, exactly. So I think there's going to be a lot of people back to the drawing board, basically, after this.
But this is the exciting stuff that we talked about, you know, when we first did our James Webb episode and when I was researching for the chapter on James Webb in our book, The Year in Space.
Nice plug.
Thank you. This is what everyone was talking about. It's that there is some stuff that you're really excited to find because that is exactly what Webb has been designed for, and it's gone out and it's got its checklist of what to look for. And then there's just the stuff that is new and no one has any boundaries of where to begin with that, and it's so exciting. It really is.
Yeah, because I mean, they looked at the Orion Nebula to be like, let's study star formation, and then they were like, what are these things?
But not these things, what are you?
Exactly. So I think it just showcases the power of JWST again, just how transformative it is for so many different fields that you wouldn't have even expected for it to transform. You know, and I think that's the fun thing about it, is that observations always motivate new hypotheses and new mathematical equations and new theories, and we're just seeing that happen in, like, real time, the need for those new theories. And this is what pushes science forward, right? And I think it's just, well, for me, JWST has already been worth
all the money.
Hey, it worked. We're very glad it worked, and it's doing brilliant.
Yeah, we are very, very glad it worked.
Absolutely, thank goodness.
I used to study the Orion Nebula years ago, you know, for my doctorate.
You?
Yeah, so yes, back in the early 90s, and even then it was about Hubble looking at it for the first time, so seeing the proplids. And I think every time someone launches a telescope, they want to look at it because it's so bright and big and nearby, which we should say, in the winter sky, you can see it easily yourself. So. Yeah. Pick up a pair of binoculars and have a look.
Yeah, rising, what, like 9 p.m.
Yeah,
right now
it's
in the UK?
It's not too hard
like
to see. It's getting easier over the winter. You can't see the jumbos, though.
Sadly not.
Damn. Hopefully listeners will remember that a few months ago we spoke about how much of our universe that we don't really know and a lot of it is missing. Well, on the 8th of November, so that was actually just a few days from the point that we're recording this, the first images from the Euclid Space Telescope were shared. Yes. So this is the mission that will hopefully reveal the mysteries around dark matter and dark energy. To both of you, what were the first images? What have we seen?
They're really incredible. Nice.
Can I just jump in with like, they're really nice. Can I just jump in with like, I feel like in the media there was nowhere near the same hype as when the first five Gerberus T science images were released.
It's so true. But it's like, so true.
The this week in like the university, in like the Department of Astrophysics, like everyone has just been like, oh, have you seen the Euclid images? Like it's all anyone's talked about. People have been so excited. And I think it's just because, I don't know, I think with what Euclid's going to do, and maybe it's just my department, maybe there's more people working on this stuff or something that it's just going to have. We talked about JWST's impact, but I think, yeah, the Euclid impact on sort of our place and understanding of the universe is going to be
six years a slow burn, but I can really see it changing things. And yeah, they're really great images, and images of a galaxy cluster in Perseus, and you know, several other galaxies, a globular cluster, and the Horsehead Nebula, which is also in Orion, which is really iconic. If you open astronomy coffee table books, you will see a picture of the Horsehead. And the point is that Euclid sees it. But it sees all of it, and it sees it in detail, which is, you know, what you want from a telescope, to see a lot of the sky and to see it in detail too.
Yeah, because it's a survey telescope, Euclid.
Yeah, and this was going to say, it takes an image of a huge portion of the sky, right?
Yeah, so, I mean, so there's a reason for this. So Euclid's going to survey a third of the entire sky to, like, catalogue galaxies. So it's the only bit, it's doing the bits of the sky you can do that in, because the Milky Way blocks out a good chunk of it, all the stars and stuff in the Milky Way. And, the whole point of that is to survey the entire thing to like Hubble Ultra Deep Field kind of detail.
Cool.
You know, so it's going to be incredible. And to do that, you need this big field of view. So JWST, Hubble, they focus on details. So they zoom in kind of thing, like very, very small. So if you see an image from JWST, it's about a 30th of a degree across. So if you've got 360 degrees around the whole sky, and you can imagine just like a little chunk of that, it's a 30th of a degree. Whereas Euclid looks at 0.75 of a degree, so like 3/4 of a degree.
Yeah.
And to put that into context, the moon is 0.5 degree across when it's full. So Euclid looks at a bigger patch of the sky than the moon.
That's
at one time.
Incredible. It's so incredible.
Yeah. I mean, that is really similar to a pair of binoculars, you know, with a decent magnification. So to put it in perspective, you're taking something like that and you're seeing a lot more stuff lot more detail.
Yeah. And so were there any surprises? What were in these images and what's got people scratching their heads once more?
I think just the numbers, like Robert mentioned the Perseus cluster image. I think that was the one for me that showcased exactly what Euclid's going to do, because it was a cluster of galaxies, about 1,000 or so galaxies, only about 250 million light years away, so relatively close. And it, you know, picked up all 1,000 of those. And then in the background, it picked up 100,000 distant galaxies.
I mean, it's like when you do the numbers or even attempt to just mildly think about the numbers, you're just like, oh my God, this is a lot.
Yeah. So imagine that. And then obviously they're going to get distances and they make that into like a 3D map of that section of the universe, but they're going to do it for, you know, a third of the entire sky, third of the universe, basically. Like, it is going to be great. But in terms of surprises, like there was a couple of things that I think I wasn't expecting to see, but I don't know about you, Robert, and that was the diffraction spikes. I think we talked about this for JWST images. So when Hubble takes an image of something and there's a star in the way, the star is so bright that it, you know, the light can sometimes bleed into the neighboring pixels, right? And so you get this like spike around the star and there's four spikes. And we were so used to seeing that with Hubble. And then JWST came along and all of a sudden there was 8 spikes for JWST, like 6 big, 2 small. And now with Euclid, we're seeing 6 spikes. And it's like wrapping your head around, you know, sort of how the different telescope setup of what shape the mirror is and how the mirror is supported give you all of these different shapes then in like the things that end up being very, very bright. And what was really interesting to me is that actually if you look at some of these images and you zoom in on the bright stars, you'll see that there's not just sort of the main 6 spikes, it's like it's been rotated slightly as well.
Right.
And the reason for that is because obviously these color images are made from like a red, a green, and a blue. right? And then they're added together. And so these diffraction spikes are rotated slightly, so they're also rainbow looking.
Love it.
And the reason is because, I don't know if we've talked about this on the podcast.
I don't think we have. I don't think this has come up before.
If you remember back in August, after they first launched Euclid, they were like, uh-oh, there's a slight sunlight leak through the spacecraft body. There must have been a hole in it or something to let sunlight through. And so they had to be really careful about which direction they pointed the telescope. There's only a really narrow range of angles now that they can point the telescope compared to the sun.
Okay.
And so I think this sort of slight rotation you're seeing, because like the red, the green and the blue had a slightly different rotation when they took it, is probably because of this light leak issue. And so you get this rainbow on some of the diffraction spikes as well, which I mean, the whole survey had to be redesigned because of this. So it's been a headache for the team. But I think the diffraction spikes, rainbow diffraction spikes, as I'm calling them, as cool as they look, I think it's also going to be like a bit of a surprise for people to be like, this image analysis is going to be a headache. As well.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that's what I'm thinking. Yeah, but
if you're going to do some science with it,
okay,
we'll figure it out. But it might be a little bit headachey. So,
yeah. So what's next? I mean, obviously it's only just getting going, but what are some of the big things that, do we know what some of the next images might be?
I'm not sure what the targets are, actually. Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I mean, these are obviously...
Just find out about dark matter, dark energy.
Well, exactly. I mean, the overall objective is really clear, right? But it's a good question as to what they're going to go for iconic things.
Yeah, so... I sort of do know what's next because a lot of my colleagues work on the Euclid team in Oxford, so I get some insider. So the survey start is ever so slightly delayed because of this sun angle issue.
Right, okay.
But that'll be like in the new year. And then essentially it will just start, and it will start splitting the sky into little mosaic shapes and just slowly but surely building up a big picture of the sky, going back to each place, you know, multiple times to get more and more light from each section of the sky. And so that is going to be ongoing for, like Robert said, like 5 or 6 years. But thankfully, they are going to do a data release every year in that time frame. So it will build up slowly in chunks, and people will be able to start doing work on smaller chunks, and then the statistics will get better as more and more areas of sky are released.
So with that inside knowledge, do you know if they're going for any more iconic things?
I don't think so. I think they did that as like a public release, but I don't think there'll be more sort of like, oh, pretty pictures until the next
release. I wondered. I thought, you know, when you did a survey, So this is basically just convince us that it's working well. And convince the public.
Which it did, right? I looked at those images and were like, wait, where's the telescope? This is great. And I think that's what's so lovely about them as well, is because Euclid's optical, they look very familiar to the Hubble Space Telescope images, just on a bigger scale.
That was my surprise, was I looked at it and I thought, actually, you know, yes, you can easily, because you look at them on a browser and you think there's an image which looks a lot like many you see, but it's only when you zoom in and you look in the background, you think, okay, there's a vast amount of detail in these. But superficially, they look, oh yeah, it looks
That's
like
what
a
got
galaxy
me,
cluster.
Is it if you zoom, because I'm so used to zooming in on Hubble images and then there's being this sort of image resolution that you hit to the pixel level where all of a sudden it's blurry. But it felt like with Euclid, you could just keep going, because the images are like 8K. Like the camera that you have on the back of Euclid is obviously well better than what was installed on Hubble in the 2000s, the last time it was serviced, you know, so it's just incredible.
And so how will these images translate into our understanding of dark matter? You know, that's overall the mission of Euclid.
Sure. So with Euclid, obviously you're seeing the light that we detect. So you're seeing the light from the galaxies, but you're also seeing where background galaxies are warped because of the foreground galaxies as well. So they act as like lenses. So you can map out where all the matter is, and then compare that with where are all the galaxies that you've detected and how much mass is there from the light that you can see. And you take both of those maps from each other and you can end up with a map essentially of where all the dark matter is in the universe. And because we know the distances to those galaxies, we can also make it a 3D map as well, which is really, really crucial. And then if you think about, you know, what you're seeing when you see all the galaxies at different distances and you then make this sort of three-dimensional map, is you can take sort of slices through the universe and be like, what did the universe look like at this time and how far apart the galaxies were? So the other thing you can do is track how the expansion of the universe has changed with time, if it's accelerating, which is caused by something we call dark energy but we don't understand. So this is what we mean when Euclid is going to tell us about the dark universe. It's going to tell us where all the dark matter is and hopefully figure out what the properties of dark energy are causing this change in the expansion.
And so, I mean, this is a question to both of you. Given that we've had Webb and Euclid launched and functioning in a similar time frame, you know, a couple of years within each other, do you think we're about to enter into this new sort of level of information with astronomy, that we're just going to start seeing new things and studying new things? Because I'm not an academic, but it feels like this could be like a real switch up for what we know so far.
Every time we launch these big new facilities, then you get that surge of discovery. If you think about the way Hubble worked in the 90s, particularly, you know, looking at the deep field, for example, and helping change our idea about the expansion of the universe, that sort of stuff is exactly what you'd expect from this, I think. You know, I'm not going to make a prediction for exactly what will be discovered, which ideas will be overturned, which ones will be verified, et cetera, et cetera. But when you build these wonderful new facilities, it's inevitable you find these things, because, you know, I mean, look, just talking whether it's crazy double Jupiters called Jumbos, or, you know, or something entirely unexpected further afield. And, yeah, you cannot build telescopes of that capability and not expect to find things that are entirely novel. Every time it's, I mean, 400 years of telescopic astronomy, that's happened pretty much every time we build a new generation of telescopes.
Yeah, it's funny you should say numbers, though, is as well, because in my head, there's JWST, there's Euclid, but there's also the Rubin Observatory as well, which is another survey, but a ground-based survey. And that's really going to be good for sort of things that go bump in the night. It's going to monitor the whole sky every night. So any new supernova or any, you know, black hole that might have gobbled a bit more material that flickers and brightens or whatever it might be, or asteroids moving, that's going to collect all of that as well. Like, I've heard some numbers saying there's going to be like a million alerts a night of something that's changed in the sky.
Yeah. Do you know, when I went to a conference about that, where they'd announced that maybe in about the early 2000s. And at that time, this is going to age me again, but never mind. They were talking about how it would fill a room with CD-ROMs. Do you remember those? Every 3 days. Yeah. So, and that, so, you know, they need to redesign the data set each time, it's so big. But I was also going to say, yeah, I mean, ground wave facilities too, of course, square kilometer arrays coming on stream, the big radio observatory, ELT as well. You know, what will be the largest telescope on Earth is under construction in Chile. Yeah. So that, you know, imagine what that's going to do. It's going to be many times bigger than, we'll have a mirror that's many times bigger than Webb.
And then you've got LOFAR as well, the radio telescope, you ready for this fact? It will take data faster than we can get it off the telescope.
Wild.
Yeah.
I mean, that is wild.
Yeah, like our data transfer skills, right, is just not up to scratch with it. And this is the thing. I think we're ready for just, I don't think, maybe we're ready, maybe we're not ready for this inundation of data. And I think all of these are going to help work together so that in the next 10 years, we're just going to see an unprecedented amount of results coming out. So JWST, you know, habitability of planets, the distant universe, you know, how the universe formed, Euclid, the dark universe, you know, Rubin, all of the transient stuff that changes. Like, it's just, I just so many working together, I think is the thing. Like, we're almost spoilt with how many incredible observatories we have right now.
Oh, what a month for space news. We've covered a lot today. And I just want to say, we are planning for next year. So if you're listening to this and you think, I've got a topic that I want the Supermassive team to cover, then do email it over to us. It's podcast@ras.ac.uk. You can find us on Twitter or X or whatever you're calling it, at Royal Astrosoc. And we're also on Instagram at Supermassive Pod.
We will be back in 2 weeks' time with an episode on Neptune, which I think is my second favourite planet after Saturn. So you really are spoiling me this year, Izzy, that you're giving us episodes on all of the planets. I'm so excited. But until next time, everybody, happy stargazing.